Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Wednesday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. We have good, and bad slash crazy martinis for you today. Just three, but the last one is both bad and crazy. But having two good martinis in 2016, Ian, I don't know if this is the only time this has happened, but it's a rarity. So write this day down in your calendar as one that mattered a lot this year. But yesterday, while many of us were watching Americans dominate in the pool and in the gymnastics events at the Olympics, it was primary day in a couple of different states, and a lot of eyes were on the Wisconsin House primary in the 1st Congressional District. That's where House Speaker Paul Ryan was once again trying to win the Republican nomination. But it's been a high-profile primary against a very feisty challenger named Paul Nehlen, who's basically cast himself in the Trump mode. He's talked about the wall around Paul Ryan's house that Paul Ryan won't allow on the border, talking about trade in the same way that Trump has in a lot of ways. Trump retweeted something he said, which added a lot of fuel to the buzz around Nehlen's campaign. It got Ann Coulter to come into the district to campaign for him. It got Sarah Palin to campaign for him and a few other people who are very much pro-Trump. Even heading into the later part of last week, Ian, the polls showed that Paul Ryan might have a lead as much as 66 points. Everyone said, I don't know what the deal is with that poll. It can't possibly be right. Ryan will probably win, but there's no way it's that big of a margin. And they were right. It wasn't 66 points. It was 68 points, 84% for Paul Ryan, 16% for Paul Nehlen. With all the buzz he got with the alt-right, it collapsed. And that's not to say that Paul Ryan is a perfect conservative. A lot of folks have problems with him on immigration. They think he's done little to fight back on a lot of these debt ceiling raises and omnibus votes and all sorts of other things. But in the end, it was Paul Ryan versus a Trump clone, and Paul Ryan dominated.
Exactly right. Somebody pointed out yesterday the real metric of whether Paul Ryan really succeeded in this race or did well in this race was whether he was going to be north or south of John Boehner's margin in his last reelection bid, which I think was Boehner got 70-something percent of the vote. So you know, Ryan hurtled past that marker. Two takeaways here. The first is that when you run a weak candidate, you're probably going to have weak results. The presidential election seems to be the one major counterexample, but Nehlen was not a serious candidate. He was more of an id to sort of provide a vessel for these Trump-style impulses, which leads to the second point, which is that Trump is sui generis, and it really does seem to be the case that you can't translate Trumpism, or at least we haven't seen it successfully translated yet. And last night, the Wisconsin 1st District primary was sort of the test case, at least so far, about whether a Trump-style candidate who is not Donald Trump can succeed. And you had sort of this perfect symbolic example in taking on Ryan. It fell utterly flat. So we're obviously going to be doing a whole lot of diagnosing and the rest as the election season continues, and certainly afterward, especially if Trump loses in November. We'll be figuring out, you know, is this really a movement? Is there really sort of a broader ideological thing happening here, or is this largely a cult of personality? And after last night, you have to probably move the meter a bit more toward a cult of personality, simply because we haven't seen that Trump dynamic translated elsewhere.
A couple other things I'd note is that towards the end, Nehlen, since it was an open primary, was openly advocating that Democrats vote. And I think a lot of Republicans probably didn't appreciate that. But Ian, even bigger than that, I think we're missing the big story here. Donald Trump's endorsement is worth 68 points to anyone he endorses. And I think everyone's just going to be clamoring for this now.
Yeah, this is a funny thing. And the problem here, to a certain extent, and I know this will work among hardcore Trump people, and obviously it won't among, you know, people who have maintained more or less their faculties for critical reasoning. Trump played this game where he got to yank Ryan, right, with the non-endorsement 2 weeks ago. And everybody said, oh, it's brilliant. You know, he's showing that he's the man in the race. And of course, Ryan really can't do anything because he sort of boxed himself in with his own endorsement of Trump. And then Trump endorses Ryan and to at least a certain extent gets to claim this victory. I don't want to overstate that, obviously, but there is this hardcore group of Trump people who will claim that this is some victory for him. There's already some site out there that's claiming that this was an example of, you know, a rigged election. I mean, there really is a group of people who just are way outside the 40 yard lines in this election. And unfortunately, they seem to hold an extraordinary amount of sway this year. But before we move on out of Wisconsin too, I want to add there was another big primary, which is in Wisconsin's 8th district, where Mike Gallagher, ex-Marine, was running. And he also destroyed his primary opponent, I think 70-30, something like that. Gallagher is a very interesting conservative to watch. So that's a race to watch going into November. And if he's elected, someone to keep an eye on.
Good to know. That's an open seat, Republican held seat at the moment, but Reid Ribble is retiring. So definitely be watching that. And we move on to the second good martini. This is courtesy of Bloomberg News, but others, of course, are reporting on this. More Hillary Clinton emails being released, this time by the conservative watchdog group Judicial Watch, which included a 2009 exchange in which Doug Band, a senior staff member at the Clinton Foundation, told a top Clinton aide at the State Department that it was, quote, important to take care of, unquote, an individual whose name was redacted. Huma Abedin, the State Department aide, replied that, quote, personnel has been sending him options. The evident effort at job placement may add to criticism that the State Department was too close to the foundation during Clinton's tenure as Secretary of State from 2009 to 2013, despite her pledge not to take actions benefiting her family's charitable organization. The Republican Party has said that Clinton, the Democratic presidential nominee, sought to help contributors to the foundation in a pay-for-play scheme. In another 2009 exchange released Tuesday, Band asked Abedin and Cheryl Mills, Clinton's chief of staff, to put Lebanese-Nigerian billionaire Gilbert Shaguri in touch with a State Department substance person on Lebanon. The Shaguri Group co-founder has given between $1 and $5 million to the Clinton Foundation, according to a list of donors posted online. And Gilbert Shaguri is prominently featured in the book Clinton Cash, if you haven't read that. And the RNC take here is, quote, that the Clinton Foundation was calling in favors barely 3 months into Hillary Clinton's tenure at the State Department is deeply troubling and is yet another reminder of the conflicts of interest and unethical wheeling and dealing she'd bring to the White House. So given all the other things dominating the headlines the last few days, this hasn't gotten the traction that other email news about Hillary Clinton has, Ian. But once again, it puts more evidence into what Peter Schweitzer and others have been saying for well over a year now, that pay-to-play is standard operating procedure for Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, absolutely. Unfortunately, it probably won't get traction, and obviously it should. A better messenger on the GOP side, needless to say, would do a better job of this. Look, the facts here are simple, and they square with common sense. You have a massive, massive, quote-unquote, humanitarian organization that basically is co-run by the Secretary of State. By donating to that, you can obtain easy access to the third highest member of the executive branch in the United States government. If you were to switch these roles, if there were the Condoleezza Rice Foundation while Condoleezza Rice were Secretary of State, Democrats would be saying, yeah, obviously, there's a conflict of interest here. It makes complete sense that people would utilize that obvious stepping stone of the private organization to make inroads with government policy. You know, obviously, the only reason that this is being dismissed is because the people involved are named Clinton. This latest story is just further confirmation. Again, Peter Schweitzer and so many others have documented copiously. You know, look at Tony Rodham, Hillary's brother-in-law, getting government money for his work in Haiti. There's so many different examples of the ways in which the Clintons have enriched themselves and their, you know, friends through the government, and then the ways in which they've exploited their nonprofit operations, or the ways that other people have exploited those nonprofits to gain access to them. So, I mean, the evidence here is just rock solid, and it'll continue to come out probably for years as, you know, more and more of these emails get released and things become, things are declassified and the rest. But the fact that it's not the pivotal story in this election is a true misfortune of circumstance.
So yesterday, Ian, should have been a big day for Trump. You got this information coming out, which is obviously potentially very damaging for Hillary Clinton. And, of course, yesterday morning, as we discussed, the big story was the fact that the father of the Orlando nightclub shooter was not only at a Hillary Clinton rally, he was in the camera shot right behind her, just a few rows off in prime VIP seating. The campaign, of course, claims that they had no idea he was there. She has now renounced his support, yada, yada, yada. But anyway, this should have been red meat for Trump. As you pointed out yesterday, it was a big, fat, slow softball pitch over the plate. And so what does he do? Well, he completely whiffs and makes himself the story again by another comment that has the news media apoplectic. And here's what he said in North Carolina.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick... If she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know. But I'll tell you what, that will be a horrible day.
And so many people saying that the Second Amendment folks could stop Hillary Clinton from putting her liberal judges on the court through exercising their Second Amendment rights by potentially, I don't know, killing Hillary or killing her judicial nominees. That was certainly the reaction of the liberal media and the Clinton campaign itself. Susan Collins, who has recently announced that she is not supporting Trump, probably has the more accurate assessment here. This is courtesy of CNN.
Donald Trump has made so many disparaging and reckless comments that it's not surprising that this one has been misinterpreted. It's very rare for me to come to his defense, and as you know, I do not support him to be our next president. But in this case, I truly interpreted his comments as saying Second Amendment advocates in every state, that they have a lot of political clout and that they could work together to prevent Hillary Clinton from becoming president. I really did not see it in any way as inciting violence or as a call for violence.
I would differ with that a little bit, Ian, because he was suggesting that they could do something after Clinton was elected, and that might mean somehow finding a way to sink these nominees, because the gun lobby is very powerful on Capitol Hill. So basically, worst case scenario, you've got a presidential candidate inciting violence. Best case scenario, you have an inarticulate candidate who's consistently making stupid comments and removing his opportunities to make substantive arguments against his opponent.
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. I mean, look, Trump, first of all, is an entertainer. As many people noted, you know, you look at the reaction. If you go on online and watch the video, a number of people have zoomed in on the faces of people in the crowd. They interpreted it as a sort of off-color joke, and that makes the most sense to me. Trump is rhetorically bombastic, and the fact that he would do this probably has more to do with the fact that he was in front of a crowd and wanted to, you know, rile them up than any willful intent to incite violence or this is some sort of Machiavellian, you know, type of comment. I don't buy that. I just think it's sort of a sort with the rest of Trump. The second is, it is worrisome, though, because it's in line with a Trump sort of a willingness to, if not excuse, to sort of play at the fringes of violence is okay. I mean, this is the guy who talked about, I think it was back in March, the problem is that no one in this country is willing to beat anybody up anymore. And you know, there was the protester who cold cocked the guy and Trump, you know, said he would pay his legal fees and these sorts of things. So there is in Trump this really gross, quasi, you know, borderline violent impulse. I don't want to overstate that. You know, Samantha Bee, the perpetually unfunny host at Comedy Central, with whom I have a great number of disagreements, tweeted this thing out with a Hitler joke. It's like, you know, okay, come on. Dan Rather talking about, you know, we're an honest country, which is ironic for a number of reasons, to pile on to Trump. All of this stuff is vastly overblown, but there is something gross. Third, I want to make just a quick political point, which is, it's a bizarre thing. I know we've pointed this out in other circumstances, but it's a bizarre thing when the Republican nominee talks about, quote, the Second Amendment people. Isn't the Republican nominee supposed to be a Second Amendment person? I mean, this is like like Trump talk. Ben Shapiro makes this point at NR today, and other people have made it. I mean, one of the reasons you know Trump is not a conservative is because he doesn't speak conservatism fluently.
Right.
The pro-life back in March when he suggested that, you know, pro-lifers want to punish women. The only person who thinks that is someone who's not pro-life, who doesn't understand this. There was the great quote when he was at Liberty. He quoted from 2 Corinthians and then said, "Is that the verse you all like? Like, you know, Christians at an evangelical school have one Bible verse that they really like." You know, he's not part of any of these groups. He doesn't understand them, and he constantly refers to them in ways that show that he's outside of them. Perhaps the most obvious example was all throughout the primaries, he would talk about the Republicans as he's running for the nomination of the party. This is a smaller point underneath the others in this particular episode, but it's just another reminder that all the people who think that he's some sort of paragon of whatever the conservative movement is supposed to be, completely ignore the fact that he always talks about everything conservatism and the Republican Party has been for the past decades as something completely foreign to himself.
And then the other thing that always happens is that the great thing, according to his supporters, is that Trump always says what he means, but constantly
yes.
His surrogates, whether it's Newt or Hannity or some of the others that are out there, Mike Huckabee, are constantly interpreting the comments to make them
that's exactly right.
Into some sort of Republican or conservative mind. It's just amazing. I mean, the guy could practically belch out there, and Newt would probably talk about how it's a reference to how we need an all-the-above energy policy or something. It's just incredible.
Yeah, yeah. Trump tells it like it is, but not that time. You have to understand. Yeah, it's extraordinary. But look, that's when you've signed on to a cult of personality, those are the contortions into which you have to twist yourself.
I just assume it's because they will do anything to make sure that Hillary's not president. But wow, that's got to be an exhausting job, and they're probably not getting paid for it. Ian, we'll talk to you tomorrow. Have a great day.
All right. Sounds good, Greg. Thanks.
Ian Tuttle of National Review is in for Jim Garrity today. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks for being with us today. And be sure to tune in again on Thursday for the next 3 Martini Lunch.